Today's Wednesday, March 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What are the big takeaways from the World Health Organization's report on the origin of COVID-19?
Sometimes it can take a significant time to find the source of it.
Plus, the United States releases a report on the state of global human rights.
The trend lines on human rights continue to move in the wrong direction.
And a squishy robot helps firefighters assess dangerous situations. We'll have these stories and more next. Members of an international team that looked into the origins of COVID-19 with Chinese colleagues released the findings of their study at the World Health Organization on Tuesday. WHO team member Dr. Thea Fisher.
We have looked, really scrutinized the respiratory data, and so far we have not been able to document any substantial transmission of SARS coronavirus in the months preceding the outbreak in December. However, we cannot exclude that there have been milder cases and there might have been smaller epidemics that have gone under the radar. As with our current knowledge of COVID-19, some of these cases, and that's actually the vast majority, they might only have mild symptoms.
The WHO team said its mission never expected to come up with a final answer this trip as to the disease's origins, and that research was a work in progress. Donna Patterson is the chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Philosophy at Delaware State University. She specializes in African and African diaspora studies with particular expertise in global health, history of medicine, politics, pharmaceutical markets, epidemics, and gender. I asked her what she thought was the key takeaway from the study.
When you're thinking about emerging disease, both, you know, something as recent as COVID-19, which that the world only came to know about in 2019, in fall to the winter of 2019 or so, that isn't really that long. You can look at diseases that are older, even in the case of Ebola, for instance, you know, where there is speculation about reservoirs, but there's still debate on reservoirs, where we all know that fruit bats, for instance, carry Ebola. There's, you know, some disagreement on, you know, could that be the reservoir or not. And so I think when you're looking at a number of different viruses, be it one, a coronavirus or filiovirus or others, sometimes it can take a significant time to find the source of it. So in terms of the source and the origin of certain viruses, it can take some time. So given the fact that it's only 2021, it makes sense that there's still research in that area.
I also wanted to ask you about the AstraZeneca vaccine. In Germany on Tuesday, they said they were going to restrict the distribution of the vaccine to individuals 60 and above because of concerns over blood clots. And this is also after the European Medical Agency said that based on its research, they found that distributing the vaccine and taking the vaccine, the benefits outweighed the concerns. So what do you make out of the announcement out of Germany today?
I think looking at the AstraZeneca vaccine distribution in Europe, particularly the fits and starts, you know, within of the distribution on the European continent, it's definitely not helping, I think, with any vaccine hesitancy that's already there. It's not helping with the concerns that already exist, you know, in the population. So that's definitely going to both an issue now, but could potentially become a bigger issue as this goes on, particularly since we've, you know, seen, you know, various countries in Europe starting and stopping and, you know, a number of them that have at least stopped it temporarily in the course of the past few weeks. So that's definitely an issue. And also another trend that we're seeing in Europe or questions about younger women and the vaccine because of some of the incidents that they see that, you know, could have potentially been tied to the use of this vaccine. But a larger thing that I think we're seeing globally is that women are tending to have more adverse reactions to these COVID-19 vaccines, so be it AstraZeneca, Pfizer, Moderna, as they're being rolled out.
So as these health organizations undertake additional studies, from a public policy standpoint, what do you think should be done?
Well, I think a variety of things. I think really communicating with the public is very important, both at the national level, but really kind of getting into states, towns, communities, community centers, and really getting information to people.
Donna Patterson teaches at Delaware State University. 25 heads of government and international agencies came together in a joint call to signal high-level political action needed to protect the world from future health crises. The group said the international community should work together towards a new international treaty for pandemic preparedness and response to build a more robust global health architecture that will protect future generations. The views of the world leaders were published in a commentary on March 30th in several newspapers around the world. Speaking in Geneva, World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus welcomed the announcement.
The idea behind the proposal for such a treaty is to systematically tackle the gaps exposed by COVID-19. The world has come together as never before to take on this crisis. Now we must leverage the new opportunities for global cooperation and innovation.
Dr. Tedros said that the treaty would strengthen the implementation of the WHO's international health regulations and provide a framework for global cooperation and solidarity. Myanmar's many ethnic rebel groups are split on whether to step in to support the protesters as the violence widens to draw in border areas. Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder has more.
This Thai village is on heightened alert after airstrikes just over the border in Myanmar forced thousands to flee and raised the fear of armed clashes, following an escalation in the military's crackdown on anti-coup protesters. Jumi, who runs a restaurant in Thailand's northern My Hong Son province, says if something happens, they were told to grab their bags and escape.
They have been drilled by the authorities and assistant village chief, teaching the villagers what they should do.
Fighting has flared in recent days between the army and rebel forces in the east and north. Myanmar has 24 or so ethnic armed factions, and they control vast swathes of the country. Most agreed ceasefires in recent years. But now many anti-coup protesters want them to join forces and take on the ruling junta. Lord Sirk is a Myanmar rebel general from a group called the Restoration Council of Shan State at his base in Chiang Mai, northern Thailand. He agrees with the protesters that the groups must form a federal army.
If the ethnic arms group's ideology is to protect their own people and the country, they should no longer be able to just stand by and do nothing. We now have one common enemy. We need to join hands and work together.
Other groups are reluctant. Back in My Hong Son, Ku U Ray of the Karenni National Progressive Party says the Myanmar military could use the involvement of rebel groups to its advantage.
The police and the army.
It might encourage soldiers and police to more violence, he says, and they could accuse us of being behind it. Thailand has been accused of helping the Myanmar military. On Monday, it denied turning back thousands of refugees. And in early March, the Thai army denied sending sacks of rice to Myanmar military units across the border after local reports surfaced.
Reuters' Lucy Fielder. Seven people fleeing military airstrikes in Myanmar were allowed to cross into a Thai border village Tuesday, where they received medical treatment, as Thailand's prime minister said authorities had asked others who fled to return. Thailand has denied accusations from activists of pushing back thousands of people trying to flee violence against those opposing the February 1st military coup. The International Criminal Court upheld the convictions and a prison sentence of a former Congolese warlord Tuesday, dismissing his lawyer's arguments. The legal errors tainted his original trial. Bosco Ntaganda was sentenced to 30 years in prison after the ICC found him guilty in 2019 of 18 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity, including murder, rape, sexual slavery, and using child soldiers. Ntaganda commended members of the Union of Congolese Patriots Militia who committed brutal acts during an ethnic conflict in a mineral-rich area of the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2002 and 2003.
This is Science in a Minute.
Because of a growing problem called light pollution, more of us are unable to witness the full, breathtaking beauty and majesty of the sparkling Milky Way. Light pollution is defined as the brightening of the night sky from artificial light sources such as street lights. A new study from scientists in the U.S., Slovakia, and Spain provides evidence that satellites and other artificial objects that orbit Earth are also contributing more to light pollution than previously understood. The study, which will be published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, Letters, suggests that these Earth-orbiting objects may be increasing light pollution across a large segment of our planet by more than 10% above natural light levels. Study authors say the orbital objects include not only operating satellites, but large swaths of space junk as well. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. In a sharp rebuke to Trump-era policies, Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Tuesday formally scrapped the blueprint championed by his predecessor to limit U.S. promotion of human rights abroad to causes favored by conservatives, like religious freedom and property matters, while dismissing reproductive and LGBTQ rights. Blinken said a report prepared for former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that sought to pare down the number of freedoms prioritized in U.S. foreign policy was unbalanced and did not reflect the Biden administration policies and would not guide them. The report from Pompeo's Commission on Unalienable Rights had been harshly criticized by human rights groups.
The report we're releasing today shows that the trend lines on human rights continue to move in the wrong direction. We see evidence that in every region of the world, this is happening. We see it in the genocide being committed against the predominantly Muslim Uyghurs and other ethnic and religious minority groups in Xinjiang. The attacks on and the imprisonment of opposition politicians, anti-corruption activists, independent journalists in places like Russia, Uganda, Venezuela. We see it in the arbitrary arrests, beatings, and other violence against protesters in Belarus, and in the violations and abuses inflicted on the people of Yemen by the parties in that country's conflict. We see it in the killings, sexual assaults, and other atrocities credibly reported in Ethiopia's Tigray region, and in the executions, forced disappearances, and tortures committed by the Syrian regime, as well as its ongoing attacks on schools, on markets, on hospitals.
Blinken made the announcement repudiating the commission's report as he rolled out the State Department's annual human rights reports. The reports covering last year highlighted a declining trend in human rights around the world and the impact that the coronavirus pandemic has had on rights practices. It noted that some governments had used the crisis as a pretext to restrict rights and consolidate authoritarian rule.
President Biden is committed to putting human rights back at the center of American foreign policy, and that's a commitment that I and the entire Department of State take very seriously. We will bring to bear all the tools of our diplomacy to defend human rights and hold accountable perpetrators of abuse. The reports we're releasing today are just one way to do that.
Blinken also reversed the Trump administration decision to remove sections on reproductive rights from the State Department's annual human rights reports on foreign countries, saying women rights, including sexual and reproductive rights, are human rights. A huge relief operation is underway to support tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees affected by a massive blaze that devastated their shelters and other vital infrastructure in the city of Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, last week. Lisa Schlein has the details.
An estimated 48,000 Rohingya refugees lost their shelters in the fire that ripped through parts of Kutupa along Balukali, the world's largest refugee camp, early last week. The camp houses some 600,000 Rohingya refugees who fled violence and persecution in Myanmar in August 2017. The UN Refugee Agency reports the Rohingya are being sheltered temporarily on site with family and friends. This while housing and other vital infrastructure, including hospitals, learning centers, and aid distribution points, are being rehabilitated. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahajic says his agency and partners are distributing thousands of relief items to the refugees, and mobile medical teams are moving about to help those in need of first aid. He says more than 4,000 refugees affected by the fire are being treated for psychological distress.
Our teams on the ground are monitoring the safety and security of refugees. We are also working to address the critical needs of separated children. Since the fire, together with our partners, we've identified more than 600 separated girls and boys who have now been reunited with their families. Our partners are also establishing 2 child protection helplines and 4 unification help desks.
Mahajic says the Bangladeshi government has established a high-level committee to investigate the cause of the blaze, which is still unknown. To date, he says, 11 deaths have been officially confirmed, but he notes the whereabouts of more than 300 people are still not known. He praises the hundreds of refugee volunteers who are supporting affected families. He says they have been and continue to be critical to the humanitarian response in Cox's Bazar camps.
Last week, they were among the first responders in the collective effort to extinguish the fire. Since then, they have been helping other refugees, older children, pregnant women, to find safe shelters, escorting people to healthcare facilities, cleaning the debris, identifying and referring refugees with specific needs to relevant services.
The UNHCR is urgently appealing for international support. It says it needs $5.9 million immediately to deal with the aftermath of the catastrophic fire. This is only a small portion of the $294.5 million it requires to implement its humanitarian operation in Bangladesh this year. So far, only 20% of that amount is funded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Dozens of international donor nations have pledged a total of $6.4 billion in aid to help tackle war-ravaged Syria's deepening humanitarian and economic crises, as well as to help neighboring countries that are hosting refugees. Lisa Bry reports that they came up short of the $10 billion the United Nations had hoped for.
This is the 5th humanitarian pledging conference for Syrians since our country plunged into a brutal and ongoing civil war a decade ago. Instead of getting better, the UN relief chief, Mark Lowcock, says their humanitarian situation is getting worse.
There's less violence, but there's more suffering. And that is because of the economic consequences primarily that have been wrought on Syria. There's an increase in the number of people who are in need of humanitarian assistance, and the scale and severity of their needs is also higher than it's ever been.
Lowcock says the UN is matching the soaring needs with its biggest ever response plan. But that costs money. Of the $10 billion the UN aimed to raise at the Brussels conference, $4.2 billion is for Syrians inside their country, and another $5.8 billion for Syrian refugees and their hosts in the Middle East. The billions requested come at a time when the coronavirus pandemic has crippled many economies and aid workers fear Syria donor fatigue. That's apparently not the case with the European Union. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, announced the bloc's €560 million pledge for 2021, more than $656 million, is on par with last year. Overall, the UN's Lowcock says last year's Syria conference actually raised more money than was pledged. Syrian needs are immense. Borrell listed a grim tally from 10 years of conflict, more than 400,000 dead, 12 million internally displaced or refugees, and 13 million needing humanitarian support. He also delivered a message to President Bashar al-Assad's regime and other actors in the crisis.
The future of Syria belongs to none of the factions and to none of the outside powers. It's for Syrian to shape in Syrian-owned and Syrian-led negotiations under the auspices of the United Nations. If they do, we will respond.
Syria is falling apart. It's a broken country. The Assad regime has won the war, but they're failing to win the peace. And that means that it will continue to be a source of instability and regional problems for quite some time to come.
Julian Barnes-Jacey heads the Middle East program at the European Council on Foreign Relations Policy Institute. Beyond humanitarian concerns, he says not addressing Syria's ongoing crisis carries considerable security risks for the international community.
I think that will mean the potential for refugee flows, new space for extremist mobilization, regional spillover and instability. All of these are risks that will affect Europe in particular.
UN humanitarian chief Lowcock put it another way. He said supporting Syria's children was in everybody's interest, including for strategic reasons. What will they be like when they grow up, he asked, if all they know is a world of war and if all they see is suffering? Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Analysts say the U.S. needs to use its diplomatic leverage on Russia to ensure humanitarian aid continues to flow into Syria, where 90% of the population lives in poverty and is completely aid dependent. Improving the humanitarian situation there could be a major advance for U.S. policy, they say, as Washington is also the biggest single donor of assistance to the war-ravaged country. Dale Gavlak takes it from here.
Improving the humanitarian situation in Syria is where the United States can achieve positive outcomes because that is where our leverage really lies, says Daphne McCurdy. She is the former country representative for the Syria program at the U.S. Agency for International Development's Office of Transition Initiatives. Now an analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, McCurdy agrees with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who this week urged the United Nations Security Council to reopen border crossings for aid into Syria blocked by Russia.
The Assad regime has used humanitarian aid as a weapon of war. Life-saving aid has been denied to the people who need it most. This past July, the Russians, along with the Chinese, vetoed again one of the border crossings in Turkey. And so now there's only one border crossing remaining that goes to Idlib. Convincing the Russians that we should keep this open is going to be very difficult. The U.S. should be using every tool in its diplomatic toolbox to pressure the Russians to keep this border crossing open. We also need to prepare for contingency plans.
McCurdy and other analysts say Washington and Moscow need to talk more as each jockey for their preferred outcomes, not just over aid, but how to deal with the Syrian crisis. Syria researcher Joshua Landis at the University of Oklahoma says competing views by the U.S. and Russia over Syria's sovereignty play into the aid issue.
The Syrian government only controls maybe 65-70% of the Syrian territory, and of course it wants to get back total sovereignty. Russia says it supports that sovereignty. Even the United States says it supports Syrian sovereignty, but of course they want a government change and a imposition of the UN resolutions, which would cause for a political change in Damascus.
The UN also argues that Syria's cross-border humanitarian operation must continue. It says that in the past year alone, aid needs for the Syrian people have increased by 20% as the conflict lingers and the country battles a currency crisis along with the COVID-19 pandemic. Dale Gavlak for VOA News. Amman.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Retired Admiral James Stavridis spent 37 years in the military serving in NATO and as head of the U.S. Southern Command. He has spent his career dealing with the world's great naval powers. VOA's Anna Rice narrates this report where Stavridis discusses the current state of affairs between Beijing and Washington.
China controls almost the entire South China Sea, claiming it has irrefutable sovereignty over waters that carry nearly two-thirds of world trade and much of its energy resources to markets. Washington fears that if China is allowed to define a new area of geopolitical dominance, it will destabilize Asia and the world. Beijing has accused Washington of deliberately stoking tensions by holding large military drills and deploying additional warships to the contested sea. The United States wants to convince China that it is in its interests to use the rule of law to pursue its goals. But retired Admiral James Stavridis says conflicting visions could lead to accidental war.
Both sides, I think, have unfortunately the possibility of miscalculating. The United States could believe that they could push forward again and again and that China would not want to respond militarily. China, on the other hand, could believe that the United States would back off if China fired the initial shot or two.
By 2034, China could outpace the United States in critical sectors of cybersecurity and creating advanced offensive cyber tools. China is also becoming more nationalistic, contends DeRidis. Geostrategic instability is spreading in other parts of Asia as well. Still, there are areas where the two superpowers could see cooperation, says DeRidis.
The U.S. and China together are the only possible combination that can move the needle on global warming and climate change. A second one would be to prepare for what we've just gone through. What about the next pandemic? In a much better world, the U.S. and China would be cooperating to help us all prepare for that.
Whether the future holds cooperation, conflict, or some carefully negotiated middle ground remains to be seen. But it's clear that the U.S. and China's relationship going forward will have an oversized impact on the world. For Yela DeFranceschi in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
Gunmen killed three female polio vaccination workers in the eastern Afghan city of Jalalabad on Tuesday. Officials added that a blast also rocked the provincial health department headquarters, but left no casualties. Reuters' Olivia Chan has the details.
The head of the immunization program at Afghanistan's health ministry, Ghulam Dastagir Nazari, said two volunteers and one supervisor in the polio immunization program were shot in two separate locations in the city. He added that around the same time, an explosion hit the entrance to the health department of the province of Nangarhar. The blast rocked the headquarters but left no casualties. It was not clear who was behind the attacks. The Taliban spokesman did not immediately respond to requests for comment. A wave of assassinations have hit urban centers since peace talks began between the Taliban and the Afghan government last year in Doha. Many of them have targeted professional women, as well as government employees and members of the media.
Olivia Chan reports for Reuters News. And finally, a robot conceived to roll on planets is being used by firefighters in the United States to help them give situational awareness before going into dangerous situations. It's called Squishy, and Michelle Quinn found out more.
It looks like a toy that bounces. It's called Squishy and was originally conceived of as a way to roll around on planets or the moon, sending back data of what it found. Now Squishy is being used by firefighters, companies, and the military to detect dangers on the ground before humans arrive, says Alice Agagino, Chief Executive Officer of Squishy Robotics.
And I figured if I could do that on the moon or Mars, I should be able to do that on planet Earth.
Squishy was inspired by the children's toy Squish. It's among a growing trend of so-called soft robots that are designed to bend and move when faced with unexpected real-life situations.
And so it can get between rocks, it can climb over great heights.
These soft robots can take on jobs that are dangerous for people, says Andra Kay, Managing Director of Silicon Valley Robotics, who spoke with VOA via Skype.
One of the things that I do like about these companies is that they get very close to the problem space. They understand it. It is a people-centered solution.
Dropped from as high as 1,000 feet, Squishy hits the ground, collapses, then rights itself again without hurting its central node, which contains cameras and sensors that detect gas, chemical, and fire hazards, letting first responders know of potential dangers. Squishy moves via remote control to figure out the situation. Again, Alice Agagino, Chief Executive of Squishy Robotics.
We would do what's a heat map. So you see where there's a higher concentration of that chemical gas. And that would tell you where the source is or the direction it's coming from.
It's a soft robot dropped into hard situations and reporting back on what it finds. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Berkeley, California.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.